all of the your in-laws and your parents are around this entire area, right?
Yeah.
So that's a great support system. In many respects, Lisa, you might actually have the ideal life.
I wouldn't go as far to say that, but yeah.
I think
I think you do get to an age though where you try and shape it so that it does work, because you have to, you know.
Yeah,
100%. So yeah.
And it's good to have the generations together in that respect, because you know what I mean? You miss out. This is how people should live. You shouldn't live by yourself at a certain age in life.
Well, I don't know. Sometimes it does feel quite close. That's when I get cabin fever and I have to leave. Yeah.
I think the 10 minutes is probably the shortest amount of distance. I think if it's any closer than around every day for tea, but if you can kind of drop in and out casually without arranging it, then I think that's
pretty good. Exactly. Yeah. It's quite nice.
So anyway, we're live, so welcome everybody to Brain Food Live on Air. It's episode 75. We have got a fantastic show for you all today. Super excited to introduce this topic to you, because it's actually a really important one. And we've got lots of things to talk about from this company also. But before we kick off, as usual, we set off with a bit of a sound check. So for the people who are listening, can you please just make sure and comment to me to say you can hear me okay? So just put a comment in to say, yes, Hung, I can hear you, whether that's you on Crowdcast. We are also multicasting on LinkedIn, Facebook, and on Periscope, I think. So if you can just let me know on those places that you can hear me okay, then that will be good. Okay, it looks like Crowdcast is fine. I get told off on LinkedIn for not commentating on LinkedIn, so I should really get back to that and see whether I can do it. I've actually launched a new app which helps me to do this, so I'll see if this kind of multi-streaming chat app can help. Apologies.
Don't get cut off and leaving me on my own.
If that happens, you just got to roll with it, Lisa.
Okay,
you know?
Fine. I'll do
that. That's part of the job. So yeah, I think we're okay. Everyone can hear us. That's all good. All right. So we're super excited today because we have got an upgrade yet again. Adam Gordon has been upgraded.
Poor Adam.
He's all right. He knows this is the plan. You know, we need to get him out of here as often as possible. But he's upgraded today, and we've got an amazing co-host with us today. My good friend, Lisa Scales. Lisa Scales, newly the head of talent at Nestle UK, I believe. So congrats on the job move, firstly, Lisa, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Hope we're going to have a good... How long is it?
It's an hour-long show.
Brilliant.
At max.
Okay, cool. So,
great to have you on. And the role of co-host, very simple. You basically stay on screen chatting to me all the way through.
Fine.
And you're the smart person asking questions to the guests. And our guest today, of course, is CEO of Smart Recruiters, Jerome Turnink, who is always doing interesting things in recruitment. So, and he's got lots of really cool initiatives I want to talk to him about, which will bring it into play when he's around. But before we kick off, we always talk about the newsletter first. So Lisa, did you read the Brain Food last week? And if you did, what was interesting?
I did, yes. And actually, I always find that I sort of save it for a Sunday, in the sense of, it's during the week, you have no time. Your head's full of work. It's full of, just life. And actually, it's quite a good thing to read over a weekend and just sort of reflect and have a think about it. So, and actually, I quite like the fact that there's just such a wide range of articles across all sorts of different subject areas, which actually also, some pique your interest, some you're a bit like, maybe have a read. And so it's got something for everyone, I think.
Cool. That's also known as throwing everything to the wall, throwing at the wall, just get it all out there.
Absolutely. And great that you've got so much content, you can do it. So, there's something for everyone. I did read it last week and the week before and the week before. There are a few things that piqued my interest. I'm pretty much interested in everything because I'm fairly curious as a person. But actually, there were a couple of the articles that probably had some personal interest to me, i.e. the Ofqual's grading algorithm. That was quite interesting. Just from a personal perspective, that I've got a daughter doing GCSEs next year. So actually how they're grading it, because we don't really know what's going to happen in terms of the exams. I suspect we're going to get back to some new norm. But in the sense of, I don't know how they're going to necessarily, you know, invigilate and whatever. But the grading algorithm, so that was really interesting to me because...
Well, let's talk about that, because I tell you what was really cool about this post. It was a very, like, sometimes when you get a technical person breaking something like this down, they end up just going down that technical rabbit hole and you can't follow it. But this person, whoever she is, I think it was a she.
Jenny Tennyson. Yeah.
Yeah, she broke it down in a way I could understand.
Yeah.
And I, you know what I mean? That's always a low bar. So
I think the interesting thing about that is, and I think the most successful technology people are the ones that can almost cross that barrier and put things into layman terms for everybody to understand. Yeah. So Jenny is a VP and Chief Strategy Advisor at the Open Data Institute. She's got a PhD in psychology and AI. So I don't know what her subject area was, but she was looking at AI back in 95. So we're talking about somebody, you know, who absolutely understands data. And that to me is quite interesting from a female leader point of view, that she's in that sort of role. But similarly, as you said, the article was so brilliant because she actually also gave some visual examples and then gave a different visual example if you can read it differently, you know, in the sense of, you know, I find graphs very easy to study, whereas other people find data sets of tables easy to study. So she did. So it's worth having a look just to see how she's presented that data.
Really good point, and actually relevant to the topic of this show, because we one of the weak points in TA HR has been dealing with the iconography, if you like, of data and finance and those types of things. How do you speak the language of the CEO, CFO, in order to get budget? We struggle with some of this. And as you say, what this lady's done is actually found a way to really explain how you can explain the data with multiple different ways of presenting it. So I've just shared that link into the chat stream. Please do read it, even if you don't care about grading or you don't care about algorithms or whatever, because that in itself is a good lesson as to how you break down and communicate a complicated topic.
Yeah, totally. And the interesting thing for me, other than the personal sort of connection I had with it in the sense of my interest from a personal viewpoint, what I was really interested in is, you know, obviously somebody's GCSE results, somebody's A-level results, extremely important to that individual. But if we took it over into the talent sense, and we talk about how we calibrate talent internally from an organizational point of view, the data, they basically took 8 points of data to make up the algorithm. And actually, as organizations, they don't generally have that amount of data on a person's performance or their previous performance. And it was, to me, again, a really interesting subject in the sense of, okay, so how do you get more data to make a decision about somebody? And obviously, in a talent perspective, it's about their talent rating and their future career prospects and their aspirations internally. But similarly, it's also about, again, how do we, I don't think we're very good at gathering data as HR professionals. I don't think in terms of how we access data and manipulate it with that forward thinking.
Yeah, and we don't have the skills for it. I mean, one of the problems I think we have is that we are very homogeneic in our recruiting approach into the HR and recruiting function, meaning that we typically recruit for people that have previously been in HR or recruiting. And we then are surprised that we actually don't have like a fully rounded skill set as a department, because guess what? Everyone has gone through the same career track.
Yeah, and I think that's probably why that we're seeing, as we go forward, we're seeing, a proliferation of people analytics teams. And you know, it's certainly in Nestlé, the people analytics team that work globally, they're absolutely fantastic. You know, they're analytical. They don't necessarily understand the nuances of recruiting somebody or attracting, you know, great talent. But similarly, as soon as they have a data set, they can do amazing stuff with it in terms of overlaying it, you know, pushing it together, as well as then you start getting insights going forward. So, you know, it's the changing shape of the HR organization, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd love to actually have a, maybe this could be a setting for another session at some other point. Like what type of size of TA type department do you start seeing the need to specialize and get people analytics people in, or recruitment operations people in, that aren't really recruiters in that traditional sense? It would be interesting to know, you know, when we actually go ahead and do that.
It's an interesting one, in the sense of, you know, the recruiting team, the TA team of the future. You know, it's probably got a marketing specialist, it's probably got somebody in comms, and it's probably got a data scientist.
It should actually really diversify all the diversities when you think about it, because it'll bring different neurotypes into the business, different ethnicities, different educational backgrounds. That's got to be enriching for us, I think. So yeah, really, we'll talk about another show, I think. Okay, cool. What else is interesting, Lisa?
So the other thing that was interesting to me was the, I don't know whether you saw the how to reimagine the second half of your career. Now, maybe I'm ancient, it caught my eye. there's a chap called Jeff, Geloff, I think his name is. He is a product designer by trade, but he actually originally started off wanting to work in the music industry. And he's written a book called Forever Employable, how to stop looking for work and let your next job find you. And this is all about reinvention and recreating, and actually how do you take control of your career and how do you take control of yourself? And we see it all too often in organizations where, you know, people want to be spoon-fed and be told where their next role is, whereas actually go out and get it and learn more, you know, improve yourself and really develop you. So that was really interesting to me.
I thought that was timeless advice. When I first read that post, I just thought, yeah, well, I'm not that old. You know, I was one of these in delusion.
I am.
Yeah, I'm the same age, Lisa. So I was like literally thinking, yeah, I was in denial. I was saying, yeah, I'm still early career. No, but I read it anyway. And I just thought, you know what? It's actually relevant advice at any stage of your career.
Totally agree.
Because it was all about taking ownership of that journey. And as you say, not being a passenger in the car of your own career, you have to take the steering wheel. And you do have access to all of these different tools that can get you there and get you to where you want to be, so that ultimately you have more options. In software development, one of the main things that developers usually talk about is optionality. In other words, you want to make decisions that actually generate more options for you going forward. Because you can't tell what the future looks like. So you want to have those choices going forward, rather than end up in a dead end or in a cul-de-sac that you can't get out of. And the advice that this guy says, I think, is definitely building optionality all the way through your journey. So very easy read. Go ahead and read it. I've shared it in the chat stream there. Okay, cool. What else, Lisa?
Well, I don't think we can actually. I mean, I know you're saying I'm an upgrade to Adam. Poor Adam.
I'm sorry, Adam.
I don't think we can pass by without talking about his LinkedIn post and, whether university degrees are necessary and should organizations be asking for them as a filter. I just found it quite funny that Adam was so surprised that he'd had so much response, whereas he's the content management king, isn't he? And I like the fact that he did a bit of an analysis on his own post and gave some tips and showed people, actually, if you want to get your post noticed, and if we think about this from a recruiting perspective, you know, how do you get noticed online, and how do you in a relatively inexpensive way get some audience? So I really like that. I like the fact that he was giving out some ideas of how and when and how you actually and the whys of why you do that.
Yeah, that was a really good post. That was like, I think he hit like 300,000 views, which these days I think is really good because LinkedIn's algorithm has changed a huge amount. So I think anything above 10,000 these days is kind of more than acceptable. So he over exceeded his average by a long way. Yeah. And he broke down sort of the elements of his post, which generated that that number. And there's a couple of interesting points that I want to tease out now because I think it's really worth exploring. Firstly, the premise addressed the wide audience. So again, startup world, you talk about total addressable audience. It's like how many people could possibly be interested in this? And he was saying addressing a question about degrees, and you either have a degree or you don't. So that's the entire globe. So he had a huge total addressable audience. So the premise is super important. The second point that you mentioned, which I thought was super interesting, and I wonder whether Adam's actually watching this in jealousy. He often does when he's upgraded.
So Hi, Adam, if you're there.
If you are, Adam, I'd actually like to hear your response to this. Because he was mentioning about, probably a velocity is the right word, like the amount of views you need to get per hour or something. So you need to kind of get a velocity of 1,000+ views an hour or something. Otherwise it dies off, which I think does happen on LinkedIn. So in other words, there's a momentum behind your LinkedIn post. And there's a viral predictor, I think, within LinkedIn. They actually published this, that they do call it like a viral prediction thing. So they basically have some sort of algorithm which guesses whether that post is likely to be viral. And if it is, it nudges it along its way.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense for you to get lots of interactions early, but then find a way to sustain it over time. So if you see a dip, you need to get a boost on it. You could game that in some way, you know, get your mates in to help, and et cetera. But it's usually a lot of work. The easiest thing to do is to write something really compelling and keep engaging with people that engage with you. So,
I think the really interesting thing for me was he made quite a big statement and tied it back to social mobility, which we're all quite interested in. And the point being is the post was short and sweet. So somebody glanced at it and had a reaction to it. So, the interesting thing as well was how when LinkedIn perceived that the post was no longer of interest, because they're interested in, are those, you know, is that article interesting to the eyes that are on the post? It dropped off a cliff.
Yep.
You know, so they...
It kills it.
Yeah.
LinkedIn kills it. Definitely. There's a point where if you've like drifted and it doesn't seem you're going to bump back, it will literally stop distributing the post to anybody else other than people who've been, you know, personally mentioned in it or whatever.
Yeah.
And it will die off a cliff. I think Andy Foote, who's been on this show before, he studies this. He's got a group that of LinkedIn newsfeed nerds, would you believe? Seriously, there's a group, not on LinkedIn actually, on Facebook rather, ironically. But they monitor the LinkedIn algorithm because they all know that this is the cheapest way to get bank to get most return to investment. Yeah. No doubt. Or has been for the last several years. And they often talk about something like a content kind of decay, if you like, of a decent post of around 3 days on LinkedIn. So in other words, almost no matter how good it is, it's going to last for 3 days and then it's going to go down and it won't bounce back. So for content marketers out there, which, you know, as you say, anybody building audience, anybody looking to build get eyeballs into whatever you're doing, which by the way should be everyone in recruiting, it's hugely important. You get your message heard, you get your brand out there, you get your jobs reviewed, whatever you're doing, this is part of your job. It is absolutely worthwhile paying attention to how this algorithm works. By the way, if you want to get more information on this, I've actually collected this into a searchable database, which I'm going to share on the link share there, larder.recruiting.brainfood.com. Basically, just search for LinkedIn on there and there should be some information from original sources, because LinkedIn's developer team does actually publish this stuff. No one ever reads it, but it actually tells you exactly how the algorithm works. And then you get commentators that have studied it and bring it from their perspective, and they've got content, they've got information how to use this as well. So
you do know why they publish it?
I don't actually.
Have a read of their commercial terms.
Oh dear, I never read those.
Nobody does until there's a problem.
Have I committed a crime?
Am I not at all.
No, LinkedIn just... SWAT team's going to knock on the door at some point.
Like... They're all wearing blue.
Yeah, no worries. Anyway, check it out and do read the terms and conditions. Don't get yourself into trouble. One more before we bring Jerome on, Lisa. Have you got anything else that you want to talk about from last week?
No, I don't think so. I liked Adam's post, and yeah. The other one I did see, which I was a bit right. The two-way mirror improved video conferencing. I didn't know whether. Do you know what? I checked to see if it was April Fool's or not. In the sense of, I looked at it and then I was like, seriously, am I going to watch a video for 12 minutes of how somebody puts a two-way mirror into their laptop and make their laptop look like a cave? And then they did all this. It took me back to Blue Peter, watching as a kid. And I was like, seriously, I appreciate, you know, I'm sort of looking at you whilst I'm talking here. I should be looking directly into the camera as I am now doing. And it's quite disarming because I can see your face down there. I want to talk to your face. So I do understand the reason for it. It just seemed like a lot of effort for it's marginal gains.
Marginal gains. But anyway, I love this because this guy literally MacGyvered a solution, which everyone globally currently has, which is the lack of eye contact on video. I think it's a huge problem. I tell you why it's a huge problem, because if let's say we're in a recruiting world, it's a recruiting show, we are speaking to clients and candidates with no eye contact. Now, if a recruiter is able to manage that, you will actually significantly improve your game compared to the competition. If you could directly address the audience like I'm doing now and consistently do it without looking like a freak, you'd actually be in a really, I think, a strong competitive space. But the problem we've got, of course, is that the camera positioning on a laptop is usually nowhere near the middle of the screen or where the other person is talking. And you're always looking down because I want to speak to the person. Therefore, your eyes are not there. But the person who masters this, I think, is in good shape. And basically this guy did, I thought he mastered it. He's simply not got a productizable idea. But he's kind of figured out a way to do it. It's basically with two mirrors, you can position something so that you look into a screen, which is the mirror now, but it basically means you're looking into the camera.
Made a periscope. You know, that's essentially what we're talking about, refraction of mirrors.
Right. Dead easy.
Yeah, it was a bit lost on me. So
As I mentioned on a newsletter, someone productized this and send me a test unit. Because
you know what? Apple will be making a built-in camera within the screen before you know it.
I want to see them get on with it, because I honestly think that this is a competitive advantage that's not being maximized, because there's no doubt. Let's say you're doing a pitch or pitching a product. You're a new startup, raising investment. You're looking down away from the eyes of the investor. Come on. You know, you've got loads of ways in which you can improve this. And he's MacGyvered a way to do it. So really interesting. Anyway, let's bring Jerome on. But before I do that, because Jerome's probably eating his French toast at this point. Let me give him a chance to wipe the crumbs from his shirt. Ask you the question I'm going to ask him, because you're actually operating in the other side. Like, you are a person that actually has budget, needs to claim and defend the budget, get all of that stuff. In your career, Lisa, having been really the apex person in multiple sort of environments, what have you consistently found to be the most valuable thing to do when you're talking to a CFO and you need to get a yes out of this person?
Yeah, so I think from my own experience, it's been around how do you talk in their terms and their language. So a little bit like we're talking earlier about Jenny Tennyson's visuals, you have to relate it. Don't talk in recruiter speak. They don't understand it. And I'm not saying talk in CFO speak. I'm talking about layman's terms, what's the value it can bring. So, you know, you have to translate what you know and your specialism into basic English, and tie that back to business strategy and the business ambitions. It can't just be because I want it. It can't just be because it's going to do X for my team. It's about aligning it with overall business strategy.
Cool. I'm going to ask you another question. This is really quite difficult. Not difficult, but you've got to be honest. Can you think of a time where you went for budget and didn't get it? And why? And when did you go for budget and you did get it, and why?
Okay. So I can't think of a time I didn't get it.
Overwhelmingly to scale.
Sorry, I can't think of a time I didn't get it, but I can think of numerous occasions where I did get it. And you know, for all the reasons I've just said in terms of and why, my view is you can go to every conference to do with recruiting and HR, and you can have a shopping list as long as your arm. But you know, my view is keep it lean and keep it very much on target of what you're trying to achieve. So yeah, we all like the bells and whistles. Wouldn't it be great if we all had, you know, everlasting budget, but we don't. So my view is being innovative and creative with the budget that you do have and ensuring that you've got the basics in place, because you can MacGyver everything else pretty much. Yep. So, you know, I'm very much about, you know, and we'll bring Jerome on in a minute in terms of the beating heart of how you do recruiting within an organization. Mm-hmm. You know, that's crucial. You know, other things, other bells and whistles aren't so crucial. So it's getting exactly the right products in place, as well as ensuring that you are aligning it to what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, exactly. And Christ, I'm going to bring Jerome on now because he's waiting. But there was a really interesting post, I think 3 or 4 weeks ago, which talked about the rhythm of a business, where recruiting wasn't mentioned in this, because obviously, you know, we're rarely on the horizon when businesses outside of our function talk about business. But they said basically the CEO and the financial rhythm is often different from the product and the marketing rhythm. They go on different cycles, basically. And the trick is you've got to try and align those cycles. And the financial guys are not going to move to your cycle because they're legislatively locked to where they're at and they're not going to change. So you've got to adopt your product development and marketing strategy around how the rhythm of finance works. So super interesting, which I'd again recommend people check out. Okay, Jerome must have finished his post by now, so let me get him on. We've got loads of interesting things to talk about as well. I want to try and hit him with a couple of things. So let's hope that the internet is going to be kind to us here. You've met Jerome before, haven't you, Lisa?
Lots of times.
Yeah, okay, cool. It's usually an awkward, like, pregnant pause when I'm not sure how.
No.
Do these people know each other? Do they hate each other? Have they got history that I need to know? I didn't research it.
Not at all. No.
That could happen, you know. There he is. Good morning to you, Jerome. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great. You know what? Listening to you guys, I was just drinking my morning tea, and I was like, is there anything in the world more refreshing than having a tea while listening to proper English being spoken?
You know what? Everyone knows Jerome is French, so we're not sure whether he's actually having a very subtle joke about the
French. I can't believe you're drinking tea, Jerome.
Yeah.
Why aren't you drinking? You're not drinking coffee.
No, I gave up coffee a while back. So, but I have been in the US for long enough to enjoy English accent, even as a French.
Fantastic. Even as a Frenchman. Well, listen, Jerome, really good to have you back on the show. You've been a guest on here before, and it's a real pleasure to bring you back. And the reason why is actually you've got so many initiatives happening the last couple of weeks, man. I was like really excited to see one thing, and then another thing came out, and then another thing is coming out. It's like an avalanche of these initiatives. So I want to try and touch on each of these because I think they're all really valuable and worth talking about. So the first one I want to talk about is actually the anti-racism position that you've decided to take as a business. Now, I think this is the first time I have seen such a strong position taken by a vendor in the recruiting space. I think that's the first time I've seen it. I haven't seen any other vendor in the space. So I applaud you for taking the position firstly. But I wonder whether you could take the opportunity just to explain what your thoughts are behind this, how it's going to work, and why do you think it's important?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think maybe I'll start by the why. I mean, although the why is obvious, for me, the why was a kind of a personal journey, because over the years, I've always considered myself as a non-racist. I've, you know, kind of behaved well, and I've built diverse teams, and it was kind of okay, right? But then as I was reading more, educating myself more, talking to Black and people of color, friends, colleagues, partners, I suddenly realized that actually non-racist is racist. That actually non-racist is doing nothing to change and therefore continue to enjoy your own white privilege. Right. And I have all the privilege in the world, right? White, male, the economic privilege, da da da, right? And I'm like, okay. So in fact, by saying it's not my problem, I'm basically saying exactly that. It's not my problem, right? And so from there, I engaged the Smartians and we said, guys, how could we actually become an anti-racist force? How could we drive change in the market? And from that, we did about a month of talking to customers, to experts internally. We had workshops and we defined the plan. And the plan has four components, which are pretty straightforward. It says awareness. We'll make sure that every Smartian understand white privilege and is an active anti-racist. Second, we're going to be a role model ourselves, obviously, right, in diversity hiring, in the inclusion we bring behind, and overall as an anti-racist force ourselves. So there's a lot of the things we do, like appointing a Black or person of color on the board, increasing the proportion in the in our management team. We took commitments like across the board. So that's our own plan. At the end of the day, we're a 300 people company. This is not going to change the world, right? Where it becomes really interesting is we said, oh, wait, we actually have 4,000 customers around the world that today make almost 1 million hires a year. Like if we could influence change on them, if we could embark, you know, some of our bigger customer like Visa or LinkedIn or Twitter or Bosch or like those big guys and say, guys, do you want to make change with us, right? And so we're actually going to set a new standard for diversity hiring. A simple pledge, we're busy writing it now, and we're actually discussing it with whoever wants to talk to us, kind of an open source project. Like, what are the 10 best practices of diversity hiring? Because I had a lot of discussions with TA leaders in the last 3 months about what do you do? Most of them like, I don't know, I'm posting my job on diversityjobs.com, right? And then I trained my managers and it's hard to change, right? So we want to do a proper best practice diversity hiring, make this a hiring success masterclass, train people on it, and then get companies to take a pledge and publish those who have taken the pledge on a website, boost their jobs, and so that candidate, so if I'm a Black person and I apply to this organization, I know they get it. I know I'm not going to be discriminated. I know that I'm going to face an organization where recruiting is done in a proper anti-racist way or in a proper diverse way in the wider sense of things, because I think it's hard to split those. And then last but not least, innovation. So we are going to be investing R&D resources to finally help organization with technology to drive better diversity outcomes. So that's our plan. It's been published and we are hiring a chief diversity officer for the role to manage that plan. So obviously this is not your standard CDO in-house that is trying to, you know, make everybody happy. This is a market facing. So we're looking for like more of a tech savvy entrepreneur, someone who really like almost an activist who wants to drive change in the market. So if anyone listening to this is interested, let me know.
That sounds like an amazing job, by the way. And I've just shared it into the chat stream. So if anybody knows anybody that could be relevant for this, please do share that with them. Because I think this is, just looking selfishly, it's a remarkable opportunity to do something really cool and important. So get to it. That's amazing stuff, Jerome. Just a quick one in terms of like market feedback. I mean, I guess it's possible for me. I can guess that, you know, all the customers are going to be, yeah, this is an amazing idea, Jerome. But have you received any kind of messaging to say, hey, Jerome, this is cool, but this is also problematic? Have you had any kind of signaling of that type, in between the lines, so to speak?
Yeah, it is problematic. I mean, for sure, this is an evolution. And that's where our own commitment our own commitment is important. It's when the conversation becomes uncomfortable that your commitment gets tested and is important. And I do intend personally to have uncomfortable conversations with my customers. They choose to do what they want, but I will not slow down, tone down. I will, you know, not be police because, oh, yeah, sorry, I don't mean to be bad, right? No, I'm just going to say the way it is. And then I'm going to be a friend, a supporter, a partner, a technology vendor to help customers go there. But there is no doubt it's an uphill battle. Even internally, it's an uphill battle, right? We launched our first awareness, internal awareness program is a 28-day challenge book that's called Me and White Supremacy. And it's a really nice one, by the way. It's 28 days, and each day you study a topic, say white privilege. What is white privilege? And at the end of the day, you are asked to journal your thoughts. At what point in your life have you experienced white privilege? Or, you know, so, and you do this collectively. We do this on Slack. When I started this exercise internally, I had people in the team saying, John, I'm not reading a book called Me and White Supremacy, like, no freaking way, right? Like, why? And then you start to go into the uncomfortable conversation, right? So the topic is uncomfortable, and it has to be for change to be driven.
That's a really, go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah, no, Harvard, I'm trying to find the link actually at the moment. Harvard have got some really, really good resources online to test your privilege, but also it looks at racism, and actually it's really eye-opening, you know, because like you, Jerome, I'm in a position of, you know, I'm white, which gives me privilege immediately. And I did the test, and actually, I'm 86% more privileged. So
crunch out a number for you.
Yeah, they do. They do. And but they have to. And actually, that made me feel quite uncomfortable. And I think that's that's the absolute key, isn't it? That it is. That's it. That's exactly it.
Thank you very much for sharing that.
Thank you.
It's fascinating, this topic, because and you know what, this could easily be another topic of the show as well,
which
because the topic of white privilege as distinct as a subset of the bias conversation generally, because I think it's worth discussing the emotive issues that you have encountered, Jerome, in the example you cited, where you had valued team members. I would imagine a team member of yours that said to you, Jerome, listen, I'm not doing this. That would be someone you probably worked with for a long time and you'd actually trusted to do great things and has done great things. And yet they're not comfortable in this scenario. We should explore why that is and then how you handle that, because that's also, I think, a difficult management sort of challenge. And we there's so many layers to this. We really need to kind of have multiple conversations to peel these back and get deeper and deeper into it. Super fascinating on this. But congratulations on that. On that initiative, Jerome, I definitely look forward to seeing and supporting the success of this. And it'll be fascinating also just to observe the impact on the market as a whole. Okay.
Well, thank you for that. And I was going to say this is the beginning of a journey. And the reason why we published the plan was so that the market, people could hold us accountable, right? And so we've actually said we will report back every 90 days on progress made on the plan. So I look forward to reporting back on our progress.
Yep, fantastic stuff. Okay, initiative number two. I saw this from you, I think, earlier this week. This is the big bang shift. It's like, okay, we're gonna go from remote friendly to remote first for the staff at Smart Recruiters. So tell me about your thought process there, because it's really interesting, I think, to get the psychology of the CEO. When did you thought this was a good idea? When did you actually make the decision that this was something you're going to do?
Yeah. Can you hear the waves behind me or no? No? Oh, almost. Okay.
You made the decision while you're on your boat. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm actually in San Francisco, sadly. But I think it became obvious. I think through the so as an organization, we've always been distributed, not remote, but distributed. We had remote employees in the U.S. and but other than that, we're like 20 nationalities in 9 countries. Blah, blah. distributed. So kind of when COVID hits, we're like, hey, take your laptop, stay at home. Nothing really changed. We kept working. We actually, things went well. We posted good results. So then we looked at like, hey, do we really need to go back to the office? Then we reopened an office in Berlin, I think was the first one. And nobody goes. Nobody wants to be in the office. So we're like, okay. So do we really need to be in the office? And now on the flip side, we all see the potential from an access to talent perspective. I mean, this is amazing, right? Like our next superstar data scientist might be a mom at home in Brazil, for all I know, right? And that distribution, I think for us as an organization, the ability to attract talent from anywhere in the world, anyone we want, is just an incredible opportunity. We see productivity go up and people being more focused. What we have not solved for is the social component, is the culture. And as you know, the Smartians are very, very united, right? We have a very strong internal culture. We're a little Winston. We have our values. And actually, we saw the resilience in the company over the last 6 months. It's actually pretty impressive to see how resilient the org is, because we all worked under a lot of pressure, even though we decided not to make a reduction in force. So we said, all right, guys, we're all together. We did not furlough or lay off anyone. And we really stuck together as a group. So we have something strong, but there's only so many Zoom meetings you can have in a day, right? And so how do we actually replace that? And that's where we said the office becomes a resource. And we are going to maintain offices in certain places, but they're going to be like not necessarily at WeWork, but WeWork-like offices. So they're more like check-in, hotel desking, where teams can meet, where project teams can meet, where management meetings can happen or meetings can happen. Maybe we'll all go off-site and you know, turn our 1 month of our office lease in San Francisco into a 3-day in the Bahamas for everybody, kind of from time to time, right? So we still haven't figured out the social component, in part because, you know, in the current times, it's not really possible to be physically together. But I think if we figure this out, then we have the best of both worlds. A diverse team, we bring great jobs around the world, a high-performing team, and still united.
And so, Jerome, how are you coping with the whole, you know, I suppose the time difference piece, you know, the operating rhythm of running a business? How do you get over that challenge?
We actually have been used to that from the beginning. So I used to say, you know, you can say it's a challenge or you can see this as an opportunity. And for example, historically, we had our product managers in San Francisco. Our developers are in Berlin and Krakow. And so you can say, well, they only have 2 hours overlap. Or you can say, well, you're actually developing 24/5, right? By the time you wake up as an engineer, you have answers to your question. And by the time you go to bed as a product manager, you know, the engineers are finished. But this is, so it actually, if you make it, you can make it work in a way that's good. It is, from a hiring perspective, we hire in clusters, in regions. So if you are an engineer, we're not hiring you in a time zone that is too far from Europe, because this is where we have our engineers. So we still put some boundaries, but in time zone boundaries, right? So if you're in Sydney, we have a couple of folks in Sydney, it's really hard to support them from Europe or from the US, right?
Yeah, interesting.
You know what, Jerome, I think it's actually from a recruiting vendor point of view, a smart move again, but also I think an essential move, because you are like learning how businesses are going to transform anyway. These are your future customers, right? There's no way you can stand and say, hey, we're going to go back to the office and work in the pre-COVID way. Like, you'll end up building a slightly different product as a result of your own kind of behavior. Whereas the world is moving probably to a model more similar to yours, where distributed remote where you can, but maybe maintaining some offices for people to have that type of sense of, you know, physical proximity as and when they require it, but very much as an on-demand type of service. You know, there's similar to... Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, and we have actually built a different product. In July, we released our collaborative and remote hiring platform, which when you look at, like, we really sat down in March and we're like, hello, what's happening here? And we really pivoted our engineers. So we launched remote jobs for starters. Where do I post my job? Is it in London? No, it's not in London. Oh, sorry. Okay. Is it in Berlin? Where is it? Is it actually remote? Well, if it's remote, where do I post it on Indeed? Do I distribute it to all of the Indeeds everywhere? Like, just start with very simple things, like where do I post my job, right? So we worked on remote jobs. Then you go into collaboration. Like, how do you organize the work across teams in a way where you are not in the office, right? So we put our workflow engine on steroids. Break it down with hiring teams and introduce a new task management module. So now you can really break down your process and you say, okay, you schedule the interview, you follow up, you do this. If you do this, then this happens, right? So you can really put your like distribute the work in the hiring team. And most importantly, you have to talk to the hiring managers, right? And what we've seen in the first half year, and that's going to come to making the business case, is that if you don't have a platform for hiring, if you're running on an old ATS that the hiring managers are not using and you are yourself hardly using, then how can you manage recruiting? Like, via email is not going to work, right? And so we've seen actually really the power of collaborative hiring raise fast and make a real push here. And we have adapted fine. I mean, it's funny, someone asked me a question. We were hiring a VP of product. Maybe you actually helped us a bit on that search. And we just hired someone named to come in a few weeks, months. We just hired someone and someone said, oh, that's great. But so how did you do it? Did you meet her? And I'm like, oh, no, you're right. We didn't. And so we just hired probably the most important management person in the entire company, right? Our head of product that we have never met in person. And what's even worse, I didn't even think about it. It was like, yeah, you're right. We never met. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, we never met. Right. But actually, if you have good collaboration, it's okay. And she interviewed with people in Berlin, with people in Krakow, with some in San Francisco, some in London, some in Jordan. Blah, blah, blah. There's a complete process and good feedback. And then we're like, yeah, of course. And that's our best candidates. Let's go.
And interestingly, pre-COVID times, if you've got multiple countries that need to, and people within those countries that need to meet that individual, you'd have done this anyway. Yeah. So it's a net result. So yeah.
But I do think I probably would have her fly to San Francisco.
Okay.
Our process before would have been, once you're far enough, come to San Francisco. We have every second week of the month is management week, leadership week. So all the monthly recurring meetings are in that one week. Everybody would assemble in the San Francisco office. So all the managers get together. And so that's when we would bring in candidates. So we had a rhythm to actually get people in and meet the whole management team in one go. But then that actually works very well without it.
Yeah. And interestingly, the reason for you doing that would also be for her to meet and see the environment and get to know you a little bit better. And so have you done anything to bridge that gap in terms of that socialization piece?
Yeah, we have we've introduced a step in the process, which is kind of a ask us anything. And I think it works well. So you get to interview smart recruiters, a smart chain. That's not part of the process. It's actually really good if you think about inclusion as well, right?
Just to explain very quickly to people who might not be aware of what that is actually where you get a candidate to interview potentially a random employee in the business. So someone who isn't a hiring stakeholder for that job, that therefore doesn't have an agenda, and they'll basically tell you hopefully the straight story as to what it's all about. Super important, I think, as you mentioned, for inclusion, super important for fit as well, because if there is a problem fundamentally, better know there than know 3 months down the line once the person's already onboarded and in the job. And secondly, also, finally, should I say, it also, I think, is a very good ramp to true onboarding anyway, because onboarding fundamentally is about trust. It's about building trust quickly. That's what onboarding really is. It's a relationship that naturally might evolve over time, but you want to do it quick because you're hiring for a purpose. This is one of the ways in which you could accelerate trust, accelerate onboarding.
It's Glassdoor in real time.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, exactly. True Glassdoor. Okay.
So the same.
We need to move on to the main topic of the conversation, you two. And by the way, we could keep talking on loads of different stuff. This is like super interesting. But there is a third initiative that I do wanted to chat with Jerome about, and what the folks here who registered want to have a chat about. And that is this new white paper that you have released, I think, for free, which we're going to share on the chat stream here. And it answers a very simple sort of challenge, which is, how do you get a yes from a CFO? How do you do this? We're just like little recruiters, you know, we're kind of like have this insecurity about our industry. We've got to go and, you know, get 10 million budget for whatever. How do we get there? Can you give us where you got this information? Firstly, give us the context on this, Jerome, like where did you get the data for this, this stuff? And then we'll dive into the insight and then we'll talk about the recommendations.
Yeah. I mean, the data comes straight from experience, right? From sort of the last 5 years of partnering with talent acquisition leaders who want to drive change in their function and want to embrace the hiring success methodology. And it's hard if you've never done it. It's fairly easy if you follow the methodology or if you follow the best practice here. And so we've really literally partnered with like hundreds of organizations, and sometimes in amazing way, like just 2 weeks ago, we signed a deal with a large tech company, 15,000 employees, growing fast, and they were on a modern ATS. Well, actually, I can say they're on Workday ATS, and the recruiters are like, and what happened there was, the head of sales and the head of engineering went to the head of TN and said, man, you got to do something about this because we cannot get our headcount filled. And we're, you know, our managers are screaming at it. And the TA leader is like, yeah, but I don't have any budget, right? And the two of them went like, how much is this going to take? And so they ended up getting the project funded by the managers, right? Who actually, of course, yeah, if you're the head of sales and you're not getting your team in place, if you're the head of engineering and you're struggling to hire engineers, you're like, yeah, it's fine, like whatever, right? So it's actually interesting sources of money in organization. That's not what the business case recommends, because obviously you're gonna get to your real budget. But I share that as an interesting view that what is at stake here? The ability to hire amazing talent versus what it costs to do so is just, there's such an order of magnitude difference, right? One great engineer will pay for your ATS. I mean, frankly, right? So you're really here not a battle, but you're in a time where it's about explaining what you do, why you want to do it, and putting numbers and speaking the language of CFO, CEO. If you do that, then they're going to look at your spreadsheet and go, oh, yeah, of course, let's go. Let's do it, right?
And I think the interesting thing around that is, you know, actually it isn't the most optimal way of securing budget, but, you know, people feeling pain will do something about it. So the sales director that doesn't have the, you know, or they've recruited badly and they haven't got the right talent in place and they're not making their sales targets, he'll be feeling the pain. And, yeah, you know, that is a, wouldn't be recommended. It wouldn't be the optimal approach. But if you show people their pain, you have got leverage to be able to have that conversation.
Yeah. On this as well, I mean, again, it's a funny story, Jerome, but there is some kind of some insight to be derived from it nonetheless, in the sense that if you are able to, you know, record the difficulties, the challenges, be very forensic with this so that it's not just people feeling, oh my God, why is recruiting not delivering my people? But you can map that to a reason as to why, then that's going to help build your case also. You cannot expect people in other departments, which TA services, to know the mechanics of how talent acquisition works. ideal cases, they will get more fluent and kind of would care about it a little bit more. But again, that's your job to educate. But at the end of the day, it's still your core expertise, and they would expect you to really solve the problem. I mean, back in my day as an internal recruiter, I do remember that that was often the responsibility. Say, Hong, this is you. You got to do it. You know, don't come to me. It's like, okay, fair enough. I mean, that wasn't necessarily a bad scenario, but.
Yeah, and so here when you think about it, the story, it's quite simple, right? So very often you are in an organization where you run on an outdated applicant tracking system, as the name says, was designed to track applicants, was never designed to hire amazing people, right, in the first place. Over the years, your managers have completely refused to use it. Over the years, you plug the CRM and some other system in it. Your recruiters are working in 7 different systems. Most of your processes offline in email and spreadsheet. It's a misery. For the last 5 years, you've been running at 200 miles an hour, trying to fill ranks. Now you have some time, and now is a good time to transform. And your story to the CFO is simple. And it goes something like this. It says, hey, boss, we have this old ATS. Nobody uses it, doesn't convert candidates, and it's a problem. I want to change it, and I want to evolve my function. Hear me out. First, we're going to take this system where we have like 3 or 4 piled on top with maintenance costs, integration costs, and overall fees. We're going to turn this into one nice modern talent acquisition suite, rationalize our tech, less vendors, less cost, and we'll be saving technology costs. You can already save technology costs in most organizations. Going from old ATS Frankenstein to modern TA suite has a technology savings, just for starters. Second, the modern systems are marketing systems. They are designed actually for marketing. So they convert candidates at like 3x the rate of the old one, which means I'm going to spend 3x less money in advertising, in sourcing. I'll be able to do better CRM, so I could probably bring my sourcing dollars down when you need. And third, it's going to make my teams more efficient because finally the hiring managers are going to work on it. We're going to finally have a system to do a workflow together and collaborate together. And so I reckon I probably can restart with 2/3 of the team I had, right? I've added it all up. I'm not talking about future value. I'm not talking about quality of hire. I'm talking about a straight financial business case that says we need to use this moment in time when hiring volumes are low to upgrade our recruitment technology, right? Because if you're going to change the engine of your car, it's a lot easier if the car is parked.
That's it. It's the end of the show. That's the end of the show, folks. Jerome's 5-minute monologue has explained what you need to do. I tell you, I'm not kidding. People should really rewind to this part of the video. I'm actually trying to clip it because that's a really good way of just encapsulating. Boom, boom, boom. You got to speak the language of the CFO and the CEO. Guess what? Those folks are looking at sort of money. They're looking at money in and money out. So you got to go there first. Yeah. The things that we care about is natively, and of course, CEOs who care about it also, but their method of caring has to also be filtered through the health of the business. That is their job. CEO's job is health of the business as bottom line. So let's rewind this, Jerome. First thing you got to do is say to replace a legacy system or a legacy kind of Frankenstein system you cobbled together, there's a straightforward technology cost. It will be cheaper to simply replace multiple vendors with a single vendor that could do X, Y, Z. So you can make the first point there. The second point was that the modern ATS has CRM style functionality. So you're talking about talent acquisition cost savings. Mm-hmm. So how much are you spending on sort of advertising? How much are you spending on point-based sourcing tools? How much time are you spending doing that? All of that goes into some calculator. So you can crunch out a number, which is a huge, ugly number, and then you can present something a lot smaller and saying, this is the cost saving. And the third thing you mentioned is, hey, a hiring manager is going to want to use this. So we can increase the commitment from the people we already have. That means that they're going to use it more efficiently, which ultimately means we can reduce even the numbers of recruiters that we actually hire, or we can speed up the cost of the time to hire, if you want a classic KPI, and that's cost saving as well. So they're the ones who do.
So I have a comment.
No one's going to stop you from making comments, Lisa.
So Jerome is absolutely right. All those factors, add that up, make sure that's your headline statement and get the attention of the CFO. Yeah. CFO, hi guys, I'm going to save you X, and this is how I'm going to do it. Get their attention first. That's all I have to say.
No, clear. And bring the head of sales and head of engineering in their meetings with the CFO in the same afternoon to mention, so are you going to say yes to Jerome or to Lisa? Because I really need my engineers here. So if you don't, I'm going to go to the CEO, right? So get the business corridor, to actually partner.
And it's harder in this day and age because we are remote, but corridor conversations, those side conversations, drip feed, I've got something really exciting coming up, et cetera, that's how you get sponsorship and they will drip feed in the ear of the CFO.
Okay, so there's two things I want to just touch on here. Firstly, the idea of acquiring or at least building allegiances between other business functions, okay? I mean, we started this conversation really with a kind of a funny anecdote from Jerome, but actually the more we think about it, it's actually totally legit because if the CEO or the CFO is getting lots of signals from all of his management team that this needs to happen, he or she is going to think a lot more carefully about it rather than just the one person complaining, you know, piping up and screaming for budget. It's like, it's a serious thing. So how does the head of talent or the CPO, how does that person go about sort of building these alliances? Excuse me. Like what is the method, if you like, to get there?
I think the method, I was reflecting on someone who was asking me, hey Jerome, they want to push me on work day, what do I do? And I said, well, talk to your CIO. And he says, like, what do I say to the CIO? And I said, well, ask him, how important is you to is it for you to hire amazing people? Right? And then the CIO was like, of course, super important. I was like, duh, right? Like, seriously, you're going to force me into a direction that I'm telling you is not going to allow me to deliver great talent. And at the same time, you say it's important. So what are you going to do, right? So bring them back to the business value. And with that, I really want to say here, you got to stop allowing the business to measure you on the wrong metrics. Cost per hire, time to fill. This is a killer. This is the silent killer because cost per hire, time to fill is faster, cheaper. Can you go to the management meeting and say, next year, I think we should increase our cost per hire? Of course not. But as a CEO, I would say, yeah, okay, why not? Well, what's in it for me? Do I get my people faster? Do I get better quality people? Like, what's the business case here to invest in recruiting to get better talent, right? So if you measure cost per hire, just ignore it, right? And second, time to fill, like faster. My time to fill is 47 days. I'm sorry, as a CEO, I don't care. Like, start earlier, right? So measure yourself against hiring velocity, the percentage of jobs that are filled on time. Because now as a CFO, as a CEO, if you tell me our hiring velocity is 64%, that means to me that actually any decision I make is going to be implemented at 64%. If I decide to invade Belgium, we'll have 65% of the soldiers on the day of the invasion. If I want to launch a new product, it'll be 65% ready because we'll have 65% of the engineers, right? So that doesn't work for me as a CEO. Okay, so now how do we drive better hiring velocity, right? And measure quality, the net hiring score. We had James Halliburton actually the other day from SGS runs recruiting globally at SGS. He had to convince every country to switch over from their old ITS. And he literally went like, people are like, yeah, no, we're hiring people. Is it okay? And then he went surveying around. And what came back, and the net hiring score is a good way to do that, which is like an NPS on a new hire. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much of a fit is this person and how much of a fit is this job for the person? And then you take the ones who are like, yeah, 9 and 10, minus those who are like, oh, I might have made a mistake. And you end up with a positive negative score, right? So simple metrics, you go to the CFO, to the C-suite with your net hiring score and your hiring velocity. Now you have a very, very different conversation. And that's the way to bring the business on board because now you're talking about the value of recruiting, the impact of recruiting. I mean, when you think about it, the CEO knows that who you hire defines everything. So in fact, by saying that, they're saying my recruiters are one of the most meaningful, the most impactful teams I have in the company, right? That's not how the recruiters feel. That's not how they've been empowered. And it's in part because they're measured by the wrong metrics and they have the wrong technology.
And the interesting thing about all of this, and goes back to right at our conversation at the very beginning, Hung, was around data and the availability of data and metrics for you to be able to present this. As recruiters, we're rubbish at it, and we're rubbish at understanding what data and metrics we need to form that business case. So it doesn't always necessarily need to be pounds and pence. It can be a percentage. Hiring velocity as a metric is so understandable, because everybody understands 100%. So our ability to gain those metrics, we have to be asking from finance, from other parts of the business, different questions as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the one of the things I really like about the white paper, Jerome, which I've shared it in the link, but I'll share it also when we do the post event email also, is that it does kind of give you some handholding in terms of, oh, this is the sort of thing a CFO cares about. This is the sort of questions you might expect. These are the sort of responses that make sense to this person. You know, there's a lot of like internal dialogue, internal jargon, if you like, that is great. And we understand it in our microcosm of TA, but you can't expect that the CFO to come to our world in this respect. We often need to go to their world. We have to go to their world because we're basically asking for a decision this person cannot casually make. You know, their job is generally to say no, right? I mean, if there would not be no point of a CFO to say yes all the time. You know, a yes money machine makes no sense. So you have to make the case. And I think the white paper does a great job of providing you with accessibility for that. Okay, listen, we are coming to the end of the show. So thank you very much, everybody, for listening to us at Breakthrough Live. I think we could definitely have another conversation with these two awesome people. And we'll do that again, of course, because I think probably next time we I switch on the computer, Jerome, there'll be another initiative that I need to talk about also.
Wait for it.
there won't be. If you've seen his face there, so I was serious. So I'll be looking forward to that. But everybody, thank you for watching the show. We'll be back next week. We are going to be talking about de-biasing the interview process. It's going to be super interesting. We've got Lorne Epstein in to help us talk through what he does in terms of his coaching on the interview process. So we're zooming down here. We talked about anti-racism right at the beginning, which is a corporate and company-wide commitment. But there may still be a component of the interview of the recruiting process, which is super important. I.e., if you are doing a Zoom call and your recruiters are interviewing candidates, how do we tackle the unconscious bias side of it? What are the techniques to de-bias that? So if you care about that topic, make sure you follow the channel. Make sure you register to the show. We'll be back next week talking about it. Lisa Scales, thank you very much for being the co-pilot today for me.
Pleasure.
Jerome Turning, as always, a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Hung. Bye. Bye, Lisa.
Bye.
Take care, everybody. Wasn't that great, everybody? I think it was really good. Thank you, everyone, for watching. I've got to figure out how to shut this down. Oh, by the way, I'm sorry that I didn't get to ask you to ask any questions or even deal with the poll. But we will do with that later. Anyway, folks, have a very good weekend. I hope you enjoy the next couple of days. I will see you next Friday.